This is edition number 2000 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 16th of January 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 15th of January 2026. My name is Pauline Andrews and my fellow readers are
John Hoyle,
Debs Hall
and Jeannie Marden. On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 8 and will set at about 4:10.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes a contribution from Sandy Toksvig on inspiring women artists, a personal reflection on the career of Placido Domingo, a wintry walk in the Cornish countryside, and an exploration of the lows and highs of January.
But we begin with the main news items, which include the opening of a new banking hub, stories of self-harm in a prison for sexual offenders, burglaries, car accidents, and some animal-based anomalies. Let's start with those lead stories.
The grand opening of the Cromer Banking Hub in West Street was applauded by many on Friday as North Norfolk MP Stefan Aquarone cut the ribbon. He was joined by Cromer Town Crier Mark Northway, Mayor Richard Leeds, and Bank Hub staff to celebrate the milestone. Mr. Aquarone said, "Bank hubs are invaluable to rural towns where bank branches are often in short supply or non-existent. Cromer has a bustling independent high street and this hub will allow business owners to continue thriving with access to the services that they need, delivered by the banks that they know and trust. The hub allows people to withdraw and deposit cash, deposit cheques, pay utility bills and check account balances, and registered businesses will be able to collect change. A community banker service is also available where customers can talk to their own bank about more complicated issues on allocated days. Monday will have Barclays, Tuesday will have Lloyds, and Friday will have NatWest." It comes ahead of NatWest's closure in the town, set for January the 27th, in what the company described as a response to a change in customers' demands. This is not the first banking hub to open its doors in North Norfolk, and it will not be the last. Mr. Aquarone opened the Holt Bank Hub, which is located permanently in the former Barclays building on Holt High Street, last November. He said, "I have been campaigning for banking hubs for years, launching petitions and speaking on the topic in Parliament to highlight the importance of efficient local banking services for local people and businesses. I am pleased that my campaign is paying off and I look forward to opening the next bank hub, this time in North Walsham, very soon." Opening hours for Cromer's hub are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on weekdays, but closed on Saturdays and Sundays. An external ATM will be available 24/7.
Inmates at a Norfolk prison convicted of sexual offences have been found to be frequently self-harming using razor blades. The Independent Monitoring Board said there had been a total of 182 incidents of self-harm in a year, involving 51 prisoners as HMP Bure, based at the site of the former RAF Coltishall Air Base. An annual report between August 1, 2024 and July 31, 2025 highlighted 40 cases of cuts and scratches. The board has made recommendations to the governor calling for them to consider removing wet shave razors from the prison, and said razors should be replaced with electric shavers. There were no suicides during the reported year, which was attributed to the care given to prisoner safety and welfare. HMP Bure is a Category C prison for men convicted of sexual offences, with more than 600 prisoners as of July the 31st, 2025. Around 40% of inmates are 50 years of age or older, with 13% over 70 and 3 prisoners aged 87 years old.
A pedestrian remains in a life-threatening condition in hospital following a serious crash in Norfolk on Boxing Day. The man, who is in his 30s, suffered serious injuries after a crash involving a black Citroen C5 car on the A149 at North Walsham, near the bridge over Aylsham Road. He was taken by air ambulance to Adam Brookes Hospital in Cambridge following the crash at about 2 p.m. on December 26th. A Norfolk Constabulary spokesman said the man remains in a life-threatening condition in hospital. The spokesman has urged anyone who might have seen what happened but who have not already come forward to talk to police. Officers would also like to speak to anyone who may have any relevant dashcam footage of the incident. Emergency services were called to the A149 in North Walsham between the Norwich Road and the Cromer Road junctions following the collision. An eyewitness claimed the road was closed for around 6 hours.
A man was arrested after police swarmed a Norfolk Broads village. Police were first called to School Road in Ludham at 11:40 a.m. on Saturday. They had received reports of suspicious circumstances, but officers did not attend as the incident did not meet the threshold. At 6:45 p.m. they received another call to the same address, this time because a man was acting aggressively outside the property. Officers attended and locals reported seeing several police vehicles in the village. They arrested a man in his 60s on suspicion of 2 counts of actual bodily harm, fraud by false representation, and coercive and controlling behaviour. He was taken to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre for questioning and has since been released on bail until February the 22nd.
Police received a report that a car parked on a driveway in Orchard Lane, Aylsham, was stolen on January the 2nd. Not long after, officers spotted the car driving on the NDR with different number plates. A spokesman for Broadland Police said the vehicle was followed by officers on the A140 between Dickleborough and Scole until a Stinger was safely deployed, which brought the vehicle to a halt. A man in his 20s, the driver, was taken into custody on suspicion of multiple offences. These offences included vehicle theft, aggravated vehicle taking, using false plates, possession of cannabis, driving otherwise in accordance with a licence, and without insurance. A woman in her 20s who was a passenger in the vehicle was also taken into custody on suspicion of vehicle theft and aggravated vehicle taking. Both individuals were taken to Wyndham Police Investigation Centre for questioning.
Officers were called to Cromer Road in Sheringham at 9:20 a.m. on Thursday, following reports of a burglary at a premises. They searched the local area and 6 police cars, a van and a police dog car were seen in the town. At 10 a.m. they arrested a man in his 20s in Cremer Street on suspicion of burglary, theft, fraud by false representation and trespass on a railway. He was taken to Aylsham Police Investigation Centre for questioning, where he remains.
The mystery of the missing horsehead statue continues, as police are yet to find a suspect a month later. The figure was stolen from a home in North Walsham on December 17th. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Police had said that a man was seen walking the area of the gardens of the property in Cromer Road, but that no other description was given. Now, police have confirmed that the investigation remains ongoing and nobody has been arrested. Anyone with information, call 101, quoting reference 36/92116/25.
In the space of just a week, three incidents occurred in Great Yarmouth and Stalham that involved people selling items on Facebook Marketplace being paid in fake notes. One instance in Great Yarmouth saw a seller who had listed a PlayStation on Facebook Marketplace given £300 in fake notes for the games console. Fake £20 notes were used in Stalham to buy a tow truck for £750 and a mobile phone listed on Gumtree for £430. Police are investigating.
Holt Town Council received several complaints about the number of pigeons in town and the nuisance they were causing. It led to the authority exploring how it could deter the feathered creatures. Large numbers were congregating in an alleyway next to estate agent Sowerby's and leaving substantial amounts of bird droppings. At a recent meeting, the council initially said it would explore employing a hawk or find other ways to deter the birds. But these plans have been put on hold after North Norfolk District Council cleansed the area and neighbouring property owners were asked to make improvements to stop pigeons roosting there. Gemma Harrison, Town Clerk, said, "We will continue to monitor the situation as we go into the spring and summer months." Holt, often dubbed Norfolk's poshest town due to its Georgian architecture and upmarket high street, could become the second council to wage war against pigeons if problems return. Norwich City Council employed a hawk as a trial to see if the bird of prey would scare off large numbers of pigeons at the city's market in November and December. However, officials have had to pause the trial after pigeon fans began feeding the birds industrial amounts of bird feed to encourage them to stay. While the trial has gone awry, Harris hawks, like the one employed in Norwich, are thought of as effective pest control, offering a more humane way to scare off pigeons.
Paws on the Pier is a yearly event that sees canine companions have a day all about them. This year's iteration at Cromer Pier starts at 10 a.m. on March the 29th. A spokesman for Paws on the Pier said, "Set against the backdrop of one of the UK's most iconic and historic piers, Paws on the Pier will once again bring together dog lovers from across the region for a fun-filled day celebrating our four-legged friends. The event will feature a lively mix of trade stalls, dog shows, demonstrations, and plenty of treats and goodies, not just for dogs, but for humans too. As Cromer Pier marks 125 years of seaside memories, this popular festival forms part of a year-long programme of celebratory events, combining tradition, community and contemporary seaside fun. The pier is also looking for any dog-related businesses or caterers interested in hosting a stall to get in contact with the organisers.
A much-loved donkey at an award-winning attraction has died after 30 wonderful years. Tinker the Donkey was the oldest and longest-standing member of Junior Farm at Rocks and Barns in Hoveton. He was born in 1992 and quickly became a favourite of generations of visitors and staff who work at the farm. Victoria Earp, the Junior Farm Supervisor, said, "Tinker was here when I was a little girl and used to visit with my nanny. I then got to work with him for almost 9 years. He was such a lovely boy and we will all miss him." A spokesman at Rocks and Barns said, "He was a real character and part of so many special memories, from first farm visits to family traditions over the years. He lived to a good age and was deeply cared for by our team throughout his life. Tinker will be greatly missed by everyone here, and we know he will be fondly remembered by many of you too."
An Eastern Black Redstart has been flying around the Sheringham area since late December. Bird enthusiasts have been heading out to try and catch a glimpse. With fewer than 100 breeding pairs in the UK, the Black Redstart is on the red list of birds of conservation concern. The species is also listed as a Schedule 1 species under the Wildlife and Countryside Act. Black redstarts are robin-sized birds measuring around 14.5 centimetres in length. Over time, they have adapted to live in urban and industrial areas. They most commonly feed on insects, spiders, worms, berries and seeds. Their name comes from their sooty grey and black plumage, which contrasts with their bright orange and red tails. Keen wildlife photographer and birder Gary Moer has shared an incredible photo he took of the bird on Saturday. He shared it online alongside the caption, "Probably my favourite image of the eastern black redstart at Sheringham from my visit." You are listening to edition number 2000 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 16th of January 2026. Still to come, there are items about local planning controversies, including, of course, ongoing updates in the Sheringham shelter shenanigans, as well as other monkey business and show business news, and, of course, The Mardler magazine supplement.
And now to this week's obituaries.
John Stewart passed away peacefully at home on December the 28th, 2025, aged 89. Beloved husband of Margaret, deceased, dearly loved dad of Patrick, Paul and Darren, and daughter-in-law Sarah, and loving granddad and great-granddad, rest peacefully. The funeral service will take place at Cromer Crematorium on Monday, January the 19th, 2026, at 11 a.m. No wake. Family flowers only, please. Donations, if desired, may be left at the service for the Salvation Army. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services, telephone 01263 512 427.
Now some articles to encourage and entice your attendance at local events and establishments.
Some of Norfolk's most exciting places to eat will be offering discounts in January and February as a new nationwide initiative launches. The Good Food Guide has announced Restaurant Month, which will run across the country from the 13th of January to the 13th of February. The campaign will spotlight some of Britain's most exciting places to eat and help restaurants boost bookings during one of the industry's quietest periods. More than 350 restaurants in total and a total of 8 restaurants in Norfolk are taking part. This includes Fino in Cromer, which was crowned the best restaurant in the central and east of England in the Good Food Guide's Top 100 Restaurants of 2025. Diners can enjoy a main and a dish for £15. Discounts are also available at the Dabbling Duck in Great Massingham, the Ingham Swan, the Jolly Sailors and the White Horse, both in Brancaster. The Steam Packet in Norwich, the White Horse in Home Next the Sea and the Wildebeest in Stoke Holy Cross complete the lineup. Adam Hyman, owner of the Good Food Guide, said, "The aim of Restaurant Month is to encourage the British public to venture out for a meal at the beginning of the year or treat themselves to a special meal somewhere that may have been out of their budget. Whether you're a cash-strapped student, a family not wanting to cook at home one evening, or someone who just loves restaurants as much as we do, Restaurant Month is for everyone."
Cromer Pier has announced plans for a reimagining of Tides Bistro, with it closed to diners for a short winter pause. A spokesman for the pier said, It will allow us to create an experience that's even more aligned with what visitors love about the pier: quality seaside food, great value, and a welcoming spot to enjoy the iconic views. Many locals had reported that their restaurant bookings had been cancelled and that the restaurant was closed. However, the spokesman confirmed that the closure is only temporary, with a reopening date penciled in just before Easter. These improvements form part of our ongoing commitment to keeping Cromer Pier thriving for generations of visitors, he added. We're grateful to our local community and loyal guests for their support and can't wait to welcome everyone back to Tides in spring. Cromer Pier is celebrating its 125th anniversary this year. The 500-foot iron pier cost £17,000, which is the equivalent of £1.8 million in today's money, when it opened in 1901.
Owl Tea Rooms in Holt had a complete refurbishment over the Christmas period after changing hands and reopening on Monday. The new owner, Ali Lowe, has worked in catering since school and has been busy transforming the building into her dream business. It's stunning, and I'm very proud to have this tea room, she said. It's had a complete refurbishment inside to make it my own, with a 1920s period style. Aside from the new style and decor, the bakery menu will be staying much the same. Customers can expect to find lots of treats at the White Lion Street Tea Room, such as all-butter owl shortbread and a coffee and walnut cake. For savoury lovers, it offers large quiches and pies that are full of flavour.
Cromer and Sheringham Operatic and Dramatic Society will stage Absurd Person Singular, one of Alan Ayckbourn's earliest works. Considered among his finest, it follows three married couples across three successive Christmas Eves as their circumstances change. The play will be held at Sheringham Little Theatre from Wednesday, February 11th to Saturday, February 14th. Performances start at 7:30 p.m. with a Saturday matinee at 2:30 p.m. You can book tickets online or by calling 01263 822 347 or visiting the theatre's website.
Walsingham Abbey between Fakenham and Wells next to sea has been closed since November. However, it has been announced that the site, with a history that dates back to 1061, will reopen in time for visitors to see the grounds covered in a blanket of snowdrops. From the 26th of January, people can once again pay a visit to Walsingham Abbey grounds and the Shire Hall Museum for the first time this year. The Guardian named the historic site among the 10 best spots to see the vast blanket of white flowers that spreads across 18 acres, including by an ancient packhorse bridge, woods and under the Dell Gate. Millions of snowdrops have thrived at the site over the centuries, and visitors travel from miles around to catch a glimpse of the natural phenomenon each year. The Abbey was once a major European pilgrimage site known as England's Nazareth.
The Mannington Hall estate is set for a new visitor centre in a proposal submitted by owner Richard Ellis to North Norfolk District Council. A design statement submitted with the proposal said, "The proposal is a simple but enhanced version of what used to exist, reinstating an appropriate building that belongs to the complex of the existing ancillary buildings in the context of the hall." Mannington was mentioned in the Domesday Book of 1086, and its hall was built around 1460 for William Lumner. Known for its Gothic windows, motif chimneys and distinctive snapped flint facade, it was purchased in the mid-18th century by diplomat Horatio Walpole, the first Lord Walpole. He was also the brother of Sir Robert Walpole, who is widely regarded as Britain's first Prime Minister. The Walpole family, including the late Lord Walpole, who died in 2021, remained the owners until last year, when it passed to the Ellis family. The cafe has been refurbished and is now operated by Norfolk Bakery Bread Source, and work is also being carried out on the holiday cottages. Today, visitors can explore 20 acres of themed gardens, including a sensory garden, rose garden, and an enchanted children's trail. Nature lovers can enjoy lakes, meadows, a bird hide, and extensive countryside walks, as well as exhibitions in the stable gallery.
A new pick-your-own dahlia field will be open to the public later this year. Wild Dahlia Co. was created by two best friends, Harriet Henderson, 37, and Eleanor Amis, 41. Both women have full-time jobs and families, and growing flowers has proven to be the perfect way to unwind. They particularly love dahlias and feel opening a pick-your-own flower field is a perfect way to share their creations with the world. People will be able to come along to the space on a farm in Weybourne, a seaside village just a stone's throw west of Sheringham, after the launch in July. They will be able to browse the brightly coloured blooms and even take cuttings of their favourites to form bunches. It will be designed as a secret garden, Miss Henderson explained. The flowers will be arranged in flower blocks, with the champagnes transitioning to pinks, raspberries and reds, then into purples and deeper colours. People will be able to walk through the archways and there will be a lot of good photo opportunities. Miss Amis added, "Where we are in North Norfolk, there are flower farms, but none are really open to the public for picking. It will be a full day out. We want to offer an experience and something nice to do with the family." Dahlias started flowering in early July and are in full bloom by late July. They flower until the first frost. With this in mind, the aim is for the field to be open between July and October each year, depending on factors such as weather and growth. The founders are documenting their processes of developing the field on the Wild Dahlia Co. Instagram page, and more details about how to visit will be shared closer to the launch.
Sandy Toksvig is a comedian, broadcaster, campaigner and author. She is an activist for gender equality and co-founded the Women's Equality Party. She is a bi-fellow of Christ College, Cambridge, where she has delivered lectures on women in art. Sandy Toksvig introduces the artists who have shaped her love of creativity in the spring edition of the National Trust magazine. I was once staying at the home of a very wealthy person with an incredible art collection. He went on and on about his many paintings, without once noticing that everything he focused on was by a man. On the way to the loo, I found a self-portrait of the Italian Renaissance painter Sofonisba Anguissola hanging outside the door. This was a woman of such talent that it was recognised by none other than Michelangelo. Now she stood guard over the ladies. It made me want to weep. Back in 1989, I had a poster on my wall created by the Guerrilla Girls, an anonymous artist-activist group from New York. There's a copy in the Victoria and Albert's collection. It asks the question, do women have to be naked to get into the Met Museum? And explains that less than 5% of the artists in the modern art sections are women, but 85% of the nudes are female. Have things changed? In 2017, the National Gallery published a book for children called Picture This, aimed at introducing art to kids. It had 96 paintings in it, of which two were by women. How is this possible? Art by women is not a new thing. Indeed, it may be the oldest thing. All over the world there are prehistoric cave paintings, with some in Argentina, France and Spain, dating back more than 30,000 years. We are led to believe that these were by passing cavemen on hunting expeditions, who did a bit of art on the side. In fact, recent research shows that the majority of the handprints are female, which means that not only were women presumably on the same hunting trips, lugging along the kids and a pot big enough for a bison, but they were also creating art. And not just handprints. Huge cave paintings, assumed to have been painted by men, have now been attributed to women. The fact is, from the dawn of time, women have always been creative in expressing how they feel, making their mark on history, or just letting us know they were there. And the variety of work produced is magnificent. Everything from oil paintings to needlework. A lot of textiles have been lost to history, as they are by nature biodegradable. So how unbelievable to be able to see the embroideries in trust care at Hardwick Hall in Derbyshire, which Bess of Hardwick worked on with Mary, Queen of Scots, while the latter was in the custody of the Earl of Shrewsbury. Here is art, but here too is a deeply personal story of two women spending time together. Take a moment to admire the 19th century needlework of Lady Marian Alford at Belton House in Lincolnshire. And you will know this is technically intricate and beautiful work. Nevertheless, it was often dismissed as a lesser form of art because it lacks an association with intellect and institutions, an association that has been an endless historical challenge for women. Female artists have battled for recognition for centuries. Those whose work was recognised were sometimes then belittled by having their work attributed to someone else. It was too good to have been done by a woman. The Dutch Golden Age painter Judith Leyster was so admired that after her death in 1660, and for hundreds of years, all her work was attributed to either the contemporary male painter Frans Hals or to her husband. How I should have loved to walk through the National Trust collections with the 19th century art critic John Ruskin, who once declared that there had never been a lady who could paint. We would stand before the paintings of Winifred Hope Thompson in Dorneywood, Buckinghamshire, and I would ask him to think again. The portrait of Sophie Nisba Anguissola by Anthony van Dyck, which hangs at Knowle in Kent, and whose self-portrait made such an impression on me outside that loo, makes me feel as though she is looking at me, that she demands I keep singing from the rooftops, that women artists and their work matter. For centuries, it's been hard to be a woman and make art, and even harder to be recognised for it. We need to rethink how we collect and curate material about women in all walks of life, including art, so that we don't lose the past and we can inspire the future.
This article was written in October 2025 for The Mardler by Nick Marshall on his personal experience of the voice of Placido Domingo. Listening to 78 RPM records on my father's wind-up gramophone in the attic are my earliest memories of music. What captivated me most was the power and beauty of the voices of opera singers, especially tenors such as Beniamino Gigli, Dad's favourite, and Richard Tauber. It was beyond my imagination how a singer was able to produce such sound. By my early teens, I was hooked on opera. Growing up in North London in the late 1960s, I was fortunate to have free access to the records section of Hendon Central Library. With regular visits, I was able to repeatedly listen to and inwardly digest all the great operas of Verdi and Puccini. My first live performance of an opera was when my father took me to Covent Garden to see Verdi's Otello in 1972. I was a little underwhelmed. It seemed to me that the voices were more distant, the primary colours of recordings dulled. I went back to my records. Early in 1974, there was great excitement in London at the new production of La Bohème at Covent Garden, starring a charismatic young Spanish tenor called Placido Domingo. I had heard some of his recordings and was keen to see him live, so I bought a cheap ticket in the Gods for the penultimate performance. It was a truly life-changing evening. Here was the greatest voice I'd ever heard. I somehow managed to get a ticket for the final performance a few days later, and my ambivalence to live performance was dramatically ended. I started going to Covent Garden regularly, a couple of times a week, always in the cheapest seats, which were and still are the upper slips, where I got to know several others similarly obsessed with opera and great singing. Sometimes we'd spot empty seats in the amphitheatre just below the slips and sprint down to occupy them just before the lights went down. This way, we developed a keen sense of where to sit for the best acoustic. A64 became my seat. The ushers knew what we were doing, but they knew the regulars and turned a blind eye. In those days, tickets for each month went on sale on the first day of the preceding month from the Royal Opera House box office in Floral Street, opposite the stage door. A queue of regulars eager to secure their favourite seats would start to form the previous evening. There was always great camaraderie and good humour in the queue, as well as fierce debate about singers and productions. The Opera House staff looked on benignly, often joining in the discussion, and passers-by wondered why this disparate collection of people had chosen to sleep on the street that night. Alfred's Caff, a few doors along from the box office, would open early in the morning for us. In January 1975, Domingo returned for six performances of Verdi's Amballo in Mashira. I obviously needed a ticket for every performance and made sure that I was near the front of the queue when those tickets went on sale. I secured a good ticket in the slips for each performance except the opening night, for which I pushed the boat out and bought A64. I anxiously counted down the days till the first night, and when it finally arrived, I took the afternoon off work to hang around the house, soaking up the atmosphere. I was in the crowd of fans and press photographers at the stage door when Domingo's car arrived, catching a glimpse of the great man as he smiled and waved to everyone. The performance began at 7:30, by which time my excitement level was, well, let's just say it was very high. The tenor role is King Gustav of Sweden, who makes his entrance after about 10 minutes. Domingo strode onto the stage, resplendent in royal blue and gold regalia, and then, "Amici midi soldati." On hearing his first words, my excitement level plummeted to rock bottom. He was being mic'd. Singers at Covent Garden or any other major opera house are never mic'd. And here apparently was my great idol resorting to such electronic trickery. Utterly dejected and angry, after a few minutes I began to refocus. I knew the house pretty well by then and hadn't noticed any large speakers having been installed. I looked around, nothing. The microphone would have been on his lapel in those days. There was not a lot of movement on stage, but no rustling sounds in the speakers wherever they were. Little by little, I began to realise that there were no speakers, no microphone. The voice really was that big. In the course of a few minutes, I'd gone from extreme excitement to complete desolation, and then to open-mouthed amazement that such a large and glorious sound could come from a human being. The role which is most associated with Domingo is Otello, generally regarded as the most demanding for dramatic tenors in the Italian repertory. His debut in the role was in Hamburg late in 1975, at the amazingly early age of 34. Soon after, the Covent Garden Barlow performances. I first caught his portrayal of Verdi's version of Shakespeare's famous Moor in the summer of 1976 in Paris. Salty conducting, so it was a fast and furious performance. A fantastic evening. Domingo would go on to own that role in opera houses around the world for the next 30 years. Over the decades, I've been to over 150 Domingo performances, mainly at Covent Garden, but many also at opera houses throughout Europe and North America. Placido is now a robust 84-year-old, and although no longer singing opera, he regularly performs in concerts and, although inevitably diminished, the essential timbre and quality of the voice remains. Many years ago, the renowned critic and writer Bernard Levin described Domingo as an iron fist in a velvet glove, an expression which for me perfectly captures the essence of this great and enduring tenor.
From the Caravan and Motorhome Club magazine, January-February 2025, David Chapman writes, "It had been a cold night, but I was still determined to make an early start. I stepped outside, and once the mist had cleared from my specs, I could see there had been a frost. I took a deep breath, and the cool air hit the back of my throat. It tasted clean and fresh. I happily filled my lungs before donning a woolly hat, scarf and gloves. It was time for my regular walk in the Cornish countryside. This walk takes me through woodland, across farmland, and even diverts into a small patch of heathland before finally heading out onto a bracken-covered hilltop. I enjoy a familiar walk, knowing every inch of the way like the back of my hand means I spot all the seasonal changes, and with nature as my companion, no 2 days are ever the same. The sun was about to rise above the hills to the southeast, but as I descended into the valley bottom, the temperature dropped and I entered an ethereal world where everything was decorated with frost crystals. Beside the river, the stony ground is home to heather and gorse. By the time winter comes, the heather has finished flowering, but its brown seed heads are still attractive. By contrast, the gorse is just starting to put on a show, and the yellow of its petals leaps out from winter's muted colour palette. As the frost yielded, its melting crystals revealed small patches of colour on the ground. A huge variety of lichens grows around the base of heather, creating a world in miniature. My favourite is the matchstick lichen, a distinctive red-capped species. Though tiny in size, it adds a welcome vibrancy on a cold day. Among the moss-covered twigs and branches, at the damp edge of the wood, I found a bigger burst of red scarlet elf cups. These fungi, each about the size of a penny, are quite sufficiently described by their name. There's another even more peculiar and equally colour fungus, the yellow brain fungus. This grows on the gnarled old stems of gorse bushes and has a jelly-like structure with folds and lobes that loosely resemble the shape of a brain. A short stretch along a country lane takes me past a couple of patches of snowdrops. Their delicate nodding flowers seem to rise earlier each year. The frost which had caused the leaves to some of the plants to wilt hadn't affected them. They can store water outside their cells, so the frost crystals don't shatter their structure. Nearby, on a south-facing bank, I briefly picked up the sumptuous scent of violets in flower. Their fragrance is created by a chemical called ionone, which initially stimulates our olfactory system, but then quickly blocks our receptors, making our sensory encounters with sweet violets regrettably ephemeral. I could now feel the warmth of the sun on my back. As I removed my hat and gloves, the birds also began to respond to the rising temperature. A robin poured out its distinctive tune, and from a distant treetop, a song thrush put heart and soul into a series of repeated phrases. A flicker of something on a post beside the hedge caught my eye. It was a dunnock, often inappropriately called a hedge sparrow. Many consider them to be drab, but I strongly disagree. They might not be particularly colourful, but they have loads of character. Sensing spring in the air, this individual was displaying to another by perking up its tail and flicking its wings faster than my eye could register. Certainly not drab. I'm lucky that much of the farmland walk across is owned by the National Trust, and some of the field margins are left unploughed over winter. This is where I see finches. Chaffinches, goldfinches and linnets take to the air in chattering flocks. I always pay attention when chaffinches head to the skies, because there is a chance of spotting a few bramblings among them. Brambling are similar to chaffinches, but only visit the UK in winter. And when they fly, they can be distinguished by the white patch on their rump. Farmland gives way to higher ground, a hill dominated by bracken, gorse and scattered bushes. It's quiet up there in the winter, but a pair of buzzards took off from a nearby wall and soared gradually higher into the sky. Their broad wings allow them to catch the thermals, and they gain height effortlessly. In a bid to impress the other, one bird folded its wings and plummeted towards the earth. Not wanting to be outdone, the second bird performed a roll as if it were taking part in an air show. The two are partners, and this is their way of bonding. I also spotted a kestrel, hovering as only kestrels can. I had time to get my binoculars onto it and admire the way it uses its wings and tail to keep its head still. Through the year, kestrels will eat a variety of prey, including beetles, slow worms and lizards, but in winter they focus their attention on small mammals, earthworms and sometimes even small birds. I am full of admiration for a bird that can spot and catch a field vole. The truth is, the kestrel has an advantage. It can see in the ultraviolet spectrum, which enables it to see where the voles have been marking their territories, and this gives them a big clue as to where to start looking. It's mostly downhill from here to my house, and as I yomped home, I chewed over the wonders of wildlife and smiled to myself at the beautiful things I had seen. I even enjoyed another fragrant blast of violets as I returned along the same lane.
This article was created with the help of artificial intelligence to summarise and reflect on global festivals held in January. It was edited by Trudy Box. Here in Norfolk, the days may be short and the fields blanketed in a gentle frost, but January is far from dreary when you look beyond your window. As you listen, settle in with a warming cuppa and join me as we explore some uplifting festivals around the world, all offering inspiration for a Norfolk winter, reminding us that in spite of the so-called Blue Monday, the world in January is brimming with energy and happiness. People in the UK, including many here in Norfolk, greet January with memories of New Year's Eve. While the grand street parties of Hogmanay are to be found north of the border, the tradition of visiting friends after midnight and the conviviality of music and laughter isn't just a Scottish affair. In our own villages, a friendly doorstep chat or a shared tipple can help keep the festive spirit alive. And as the 25th of January approaches, Burns Night is embraced by Scots everywhere and by some here in Norfolk. Community suppers,
A Hearty Haggis, and the poetry of Robert Burns are celebrated in local pubs and homes alike. Reciting a stanza or two, or raising a glass of whisky, is a wonderful way to bring people together and drive away the winter's chill. In villages right here on the coast, in the Broads, or even in the heart of Norwich. Let's be honest, the gloom of Blue Monday, the third Monday in January, sometimes settles over Norfolk as much as anywhere else. But it's also a chance to check in on our neighbours, share a smile at the market, or take a bracing walk in the countryside or along the coast. Even on grey days, simple acts of kindness and connection can brighten the mood as much as any festival. For a burst of colour and exuberance, imagine the skies above Gujarat, India, during January's Uttarayan, better known as the International Kite Festival. Thousands gather to fly vibrant kites, painting the sky in dazzling hues and celebrating the sun's return. While the winds over Norfolk's fields and beaches may be brisk, why not be inspired to try your own bit of kite flying when and where it is safe to do so? It's a joyful tradition that bridges continents and brings a sense of carefree fun to all ages. If it's too cold to fly them, stay indoors and make one instead. It may be hard for some of us to imagine anything colder than a January morning on the North Sea, but Harbin in China takes winter to magical new heights with its ice and snow festival. Imagine towering ice castles illuminated in bright colours, a wonder that makes even a frosty Norfolk landscape feel a little more enchanted. Perhaps this is the month to visit Norwich's own ice rinks or find more local ice sculptures to visit. While Christmas in Norfolk is now a memory and the 6th of January marked Epiphany for many in Western Europe, complete with cakes and processions, in Russia, Ukraine and across Eastern Europe, Orthodox Christmas was also more recently celebrated on the 7th of January. Homes glowed with candlelight and carols echoed through small villages, not so different from our own traditions of family gatherings and winter feasts. Late January in Malaysia and Singapore means the lively Hindu festival of Thai Puisan, streets filled with music, devotion and processions. While Norfolk's lanes may be quieter, we can still be inspired by such energy, perhaps through music, dance or coming together for local charitable events that uplift our own communities. In mid-January, Tamil communities such as in South India and Sri Lanka celebrate Pongal, a festival of gratitude for the harvest. In an agricultural county like Norfolk, this spirit resonates deeply, whether it's sharing the last of the winter vegetables, baking with local produce, or simply giving thanks for nature's bounty, we can all join in the celebration of hope and renewal. Here at the Mardler, of course, today's edition is a celebratory number at 2000. So thank you to anyone who has been listening to all these broadcasts and to all the people who started it and those who continue to make production possible. Here's to the next celebratory number, whatever that may be. And so as January unfolds across Norfolk, may these global festivals inspire you to find joy, connection and creativity. Whether you're making or flying a kite, sharing poetry and maybe a haggis with friends, or simply appreciating the simpler pleasures of an English winter's day in warmth and comfort and listening to the Mardler. And remember that the days are gradually getting lighter, longer and warmer as we tread our individual paths to spring.
As always, our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include fighting fires and floods, as well as the search for a resolution to the ongoing Sheringham shelter showdown, and an unexpected star in the North Walsham gym over the festive season.
The Sheringham bus shelter saga has taken a dramatic twist after council bosses pulled the scheme's funding from the town and gave it to a neighbour. Norfolk County Council has announced that it has reallocated the £580,000 that was earmarked for Sheringham's new travel hub to other bus schemes in the county. And this includes a new bespoke bus shelter at the other end of the North Norfolk Railway line in Holt. It comes after the County Council's controversial Sheringham travel hub plans, which including demolishing the 1950s shelter in Station Approach, were brought to halt last month. Protesters fiercely fought to save the structure and staged a 24-hour sit-in protest for 10 days before the council withdrew from the site completely. County Hall officials had warned that the money for the scrapped scheme could be spent elsewhere in the county, as the government could claw it back if it was not spent by the end of March. However, they had not ruled out developing an alternative scheme for Sheringham. But now, in a fresh blow to the town, the County Council has said that some of the money will be spent for a new shelter in Holt, with real-time passenger information installed. It will also go towards real-time passenger information enhancements to the Cringleford interchange on the edge of Norwich. Tim Adams, leader of North Norfolk District Council, had argued that it was vital the money was still spent in the town and urged the original intention of the grant to be honoured. The bus shelter and adjacent land is owned by Sheringham Town Council, so the County Council had said it is their decision on what it does with the site. Another twist this week has also seen the Town Council call for an extraordinary meeting tonight, but as it stands, members of the public and press will be excluded during the majority of this discussion. In the private session, councillors are due to consider options for the shelter and the completion of the transport hub. They will also discuss recent dialogue with Norfolk County Council and the legal advice that has been received. The behind-closed-door session follows a similar controversy last month, when the Town Council had planned to bar the public and press from a meeting about the bus shelter's future, sparking outrage in the town. This decision was U-turned on the night, and the discussion was opened to the public. Liz Withington, District Councillor, said, "It is important that Sheringham Town Council places openness and engagement at the heart of how this project moves forward. The meeting is set to be open to the public at the beginning for 15 minutes, where locals are invited to speak or to question the council about issues on the agenda for a maximum of 3 minutes per person." County Hall officials have said they are still involved in ongoing discussions with the Town Council regarding the current situation of buses in the town. Since the Town Council has voted against the 1950s shelter from being knocked down, the bus stop was suspended from use until the overall situation was reviewed. The County Council said that buses are unable to safely use the stop, especially at peak times, due to the number of pedestrians using it, a concern they outlined in the proposals for the new bus scheme. So instead, all Wells and Holt-bound services will continue to use the nearest existing bus stop opposite Tesco. A spokesman for the County Council said, "Updated bus timetables will be published in due course, and we are currently looking at the feasibility of installing a bus shelter for waiting passengers at this location."
In a fresh twist on Sheringham's bus shelter saga, a Freedom of Information request has revealed a vast majority of respondents to a consultation urged Norfolk County Council not to go ahead with the transport scheme. Out of 547 responses, more than 400 people stated they oppose the scheme, and 130 of those felt the project was a waste of money that should be spent elsewhere. More than 100 people worried that it would harm the heritage of the area. Stephen Aquarone, Liberal Democrat MP for North Norfolk, called the figures disgraceful. He said, "It's a complete disgrace that Norfolk County Council ignored the concerns of more than 70% of the community. The funding is available, the need is clear, and the expectation from government is to get on with the job properly and with the input of the community." He has urged NCC to meet with Sheringham locals to discuss alternative plans. Currently, the scheme is in limbo, but funding for the improvements is still available if an altered scheme that retains the bus shelter is put forward, Miss Alexander has told Mr. Aquarone. Graham Plant, Cabinet Member for Transport, said, "A consultation is not a referendum on whether the scheme should go ahead, but an opportunity for residents to shape the final design."
Norfolk firefighters are now kitted out with body-worn cameras to boost safety and help them to battle blazes. The £200,000 project has seen 160 of the devices rolled out among Norfolk Fire and Rescue Services staff. Each of the services' fire appliances and operational officers have been fitted out with cameras provided by Axon for use at incidents. They have also been issued to protection and prevention officers for business safety inspections and home visits, as well as to fire investigation officers and the services training school. Norfolk County Council's trading standards officers have also been equipped with 10 cameras for use in investigations. The service says it means firefighters and officers will be able to stream footage to control room staff taking emergency 999 calls during incidents, helping with decision making during complex blazes. The cameras were rolled out across the service in December, with nearly 100 hours of footage from more than 500 video clips already having been stored. Scott Norman, Deputy Chief Fire Officer, said, "We're keen to utilise technology wherever we can to keep the people of Norfolk safe, and these body-worn cameras are a great demonstration of that." A Norfolk Fire and Rescue spokesman said, "This will enhance public safety and confidence and help with operational learning from incidents and support investigations. We know that other emergency services have experienced similar benefits."
The Clark family, who have fished the waters off Sea Pawling for more than a century, are currently locked in a planning dispute with their neighbours in the Murrums over building works at their yard. The latest flashpoint in the row saw another family who own a collection of holiday homes claim recent work, including putting down hardcore servicing, led to their properties being flooded in the past 2 years. But Jason Clark, who is the third generation of his family to fish, has hit back at these claims, instead blaming a burst water main and exceptionally high levels of rainfall for the flooding issues. To support this, he has photographs of Anglia Water engineers in the midst of fixing a burst main. In addition, the months of January and February 2024, when some of the flooding is reported to have happened, were among the wettest on record. The long periods of torrential rain caused problems with persistent high groundwater levels in many parts of the country, including the Broads and along the eastern coast. Mr. Clark said, "It was the wettest January and February on record, and we also had this burst water main next to their house. This is my livelihood. We have been fishing here since the late 19th century. It is becoming quite a bitter battle." The fishermen are currently waiting for North Norfolk District Council to make a decision on a planning application, which is seeking retrospective permission for the expansion at the yard. The dispute emerged after the Skinner family, which owned several properties behind the yard, complained about being disturbed by the intensification at the site. Mr. Clark added he was confused why the family would seek to purchase another property in the Marams recently if they had flooding concerns. Despite the dispute, the fishermen said they had been humbled by the outpouring of support for them from the local community.
Anglian water workers have been pumping wastewater away in tankers to avoid sewage leaking out onto the beach at Munsley for a number of days. The spill was found close to the village's volunteer inshore lifeboat station, which had risked hampering the use of its boat for rescues, but it is understood it has not caused any issues. Paston Road has been closed so investigations can take place and the necessary repairs made. One villager said workers are pumping sewage from the beach up to the top of the cliffs for tankers to then take it away, describing it as quite the operation. Harry Blathwaite, Cabinet Member for Coast at North Norfolk District Council, said Anglian Water were quick to act to the problem. He said, "The tankers are stopping anything from going through the pipe. It has been managed well by Anglian Water and there has not been a major spillage. Alarm systems indicated there was a fracture in the pipe and its teams urgently responded. The pipes are running through unstable cliffs at Munsley, so they have to regularly monitor for fractures." An Anglian Water spokeswoman said teams are working hard to prevent spillages. She said, "Our teams are on site fixing a burst sewer pipe at our pumping station next to Munsley Beach. This is a complex repair, but we're working hard to get it done as soon as they can. To keep the sewer flowing, we've got tankers on site to take away wastewater to our nearby treatment works. They'll continue pumping wastewater out of the network to protect homes and the environment until we've been able to get everything back to normal, so that our teams can use the tankers safely. An emergency road closure is in place on Paston Road. We know tankers are noisy, so we're very sorry for any disruption."
North Norfolk District Council has temporarily closed the ramp at Haysborough. A spokeswoman said they're monitoring the weather forecast over the winter period. They will assess when they're able to recut the ramp and reopen it safely. The weather has been very cold and wet so far in 2026. On January the 3rd, heavy snow started to fall across Norfolk, which soon turned to ice as temperatures plummeted below zero. Last Tuesday, Norfolk was the coldest place in the UK, with temperatures of minus 12 being recorded in Marham. As the week progressed, the French-named Storm Goretti swept across the UK, leaving more snow and heavy rain in its wake. The Met Office issued a yellow weather warning on Thursday and Friday, which meant 25 millimetres to 30 millimetres of rain could fall. Haysborough has long been the subject of concerns about erosion. In the last 20 years, about 100 metres of land have been lost in parts of the village. It has been predicted that the rate of erosion could continue at this pace for the next 20 years.
A magical spot on the Norfolk coast has been named one of the best off-the-beaten-track locations to visit in Great Britain. Jeep teamed up with Ordnance Survey to create a list of the 100 places that are not to be missed. They wanted to encourage people to get out and explore the country's rich and varied landscape. It came after a survey found nearly a third, 30%, of UK adults have explored little of Britain to date, and 80% confessed they would like to see more of the country. Blakeney Point shone in eighth place. It was described as a magical place, which is home to England's largest grey seal colony, with over 4,000 pups born each winter. It is also home to a diverse selection of wildlife and is particularly known for its bird watching. To get there, it is recommended that visitors take a boat from Morstan Quay. Sheringham Beach, just a stone's throw east, was also spotlighted in the top 100. The description dubbed the area a bumpy, undulating landscape of cliffs and hills.
Lauren Hemp, England footballer, has been pictured with the staff members at Victory Swim and Fitness Centre in North Walsham as she continued her training during her visit home. The player, who has two European Championship titles to her name, was said to have used the gym and would always take the time to chat to other users and staff. Cameron Walker, fitness manager at the site, said, "We always look forward to seeing her here and we let her get on with it. She is really lovely and always is happy to take photos. She has a lot of love for her local community." Hemp grew up in the town, attending North Walsham High School, and began her football journey at the local club before joining Norwich City's youth side. Hemp is now a Manchester City player and was awarded an MBE in 2024 for services to football. A post by the centre, run by Everyone Active, that was aimed at Hemp said, "We really appreciate you using our facilities and wish you all the best for the season ahead." Hemp is now a Manchester City player and was awarded an MBE in 2024 for services to football. A post by the centre, run by Everyone Active, that was aimed at Hemp said, "We really appreciate you using our facilities and wish you all the best for the season ahead."
Our last few articles cover celebrity residents in Norfolk, a station shortlisted for an award, a revelation that TV scenes set in Norfolk were not filmed in Norfolk, and a call to register your pet apes by April the 6th this year.
Jessie Buckley, who is winning praise for her role in Hamnet, moved to Norfolk in 2020 with her now husband. She was originally planning to relocate to Suffolk, but decided on Norfolk after finding an amazing old house. The 36-year-old, who is from Killarney in Ireland, has now revealed more about her life in Norfolk during an interview with Vogue. Buckley spoke about her timber-framed 16th-century manor among the marsh, sluices and stone windmills of the Norfolk Fens, and her friendship with Olivia Colman. The pair met at the 2019 edition of Wilderness Festival and went on to co-star in The Lost Daughter in 2021. The mother of one divulged that she and Norfolk native Coleman enjoy walking and eating their way around the county. Coleman, who considers Buckley a friend for life, is from Norwich and studied at Gresham School in Holt. Buckley previously spoke about love for Norfolk during an appearance on the Table Manners podcast. "We were going to move to Suffolk, where we'd fallen in love. And then friends of ours had moved to Norfolk," she said. "They showed us this house that was from like the 1500s and falling down and orange. It's a really amazing old house that's been there forever." Huckley married her husband Freddie, who she keeps private, at the house in 2023. And the Irish actress who first found fame on the BBC's I'd Do Anything has now been nominated for another prestigious award following her triumph at the Critics' Choice Awards. She is up for Female Actor in a Leading Role at the Actor Awards, formerly the Screen Actors Guild Awards, for her performance in Hamnet. In the historical drama, she portrays William Shakespeare's wife, Agnes Hathaway, which is based on Irish author Maggie O'Farrell's novel of the same name.
Sheringham Station has made the finals of the Heritage Railway Awards 2026, a national competition celebrating all things rail. The recently introduced Station of the Year category has four on the shortlist this year, including the Cambrian Heritage Railway's Oswestry Station, Blue Anchor Station on the West Somerset Railway, and Seathorne Bank Station on the Lincolnshire Coast Light Railway. A spokesman for the North Norfolk Railway said, "We were thrilled to hear that Sheringham Station had been shortlisted for the 2026 Heritage Railway Awards. Our teams work hard each year to preserve and care for our stations, and it's wonderful to see their efforts reflected in nominations like this." Sheringham's original station was reopened in 1975 as the main station of the North Norfolk Railway. The station has been restored close to its 1955 appearance, when British Railways was responsible for the line.
Inspector Linley returned to BBC One this week after a 20-year hiatus. The new series follows D.I. Linley as he is assigned to the Three Counties Major Investigation Team, which investigates crimes throughout Norfolk, Suffolk and Cambridgeshire. Despite being set in East Anglia, the entire series was filmed in Ireland, which means some famous spots in Norfolk look rather different. The base for the series is Horsford Police Station, which is depicted as a large policing hub packed with officers and cars. In reality, Horsford Police Station does not exist, with the nearest stations in Norwich. The first episode is set in a nondescript coastal spot, with the characters travelling to an island for the crime scene of a murder. The picturesque island is a far cry from the ones that Norfolk locals will recognise, including Skolt Head Island and Haddiscoe Island. Norwich is also featured in the drama, as it is where the morgue is based. But the modern building with greenery outside is one that people will not see in the city. Viewers were quick to point out the lack of East Anglian accents, with D.I. Linley's second-in-command, D.S. Barbara Havers, who is from Swaffham, sounding like she came from East London. One fan of the show said, "Not a Norfolk or Suffolk twang in sight."
Have you ever seen someone walking their pet monkey down the seafront in Sheringham, Hocombe or Cromer? For an area that had no registered monkeys living in it, as of 2023, an official warning about keeping primates as pets might seem pretty bananas. But North Norfolk District Council has issued an official statement urging anyone who privately owns a monkey in Norfolk to get a licence before the 6th of April. The unusual Facebook post urged exotic pet owners, who are at risk of jail time if they fail to obtain a licence, to take action before it is too late. It even includes the catchy hashtag of #primatelicenses. The new rules, known as Animal Welfare Primate Licences Regulations 2024, make it illegal to keep a monkey as a pet without having a licence. They aim to improve the lives of intelligent primates with complex emotional, social and cognitive needs that are difficult to meet in most domestic environments. Existing monkey owners must apply for a licence, but they will only be issued to owners who can meet strict zoo-level welfare standards. To meet these criteria, primates will need access to both indoor and outdoor areas with shelter, shade, natural planting and space for climbing and privacy. Monkey owners with just one ape to their name must also expand their troop and buy some more primates if they want a chance of getting it approved. Under the new law, pet monkeys must be kept in social groups unless a vet advises otherwise. Illegal monkey owners could be slapped with an unlimited fine or even face jail time under the Animal Welfare Act of 2006. In 2023, a survey by wildlife charity Born Free revealed how many exotic licensed animals were living in Norfolk. It found that only one monkey, a black and white ruffled lemur, was being kept as a pet in Nelson's County in Breckland. Ironically, no licensed monkeys were found to be living in North Norfolk at the time, only a pair of camels and three tapirs.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please, remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was David Mitchell, and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!